Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today I'll be speaking with Kimberly Fain, author of the book Black Hollywood, From Butlers to Superheroes, The Changing Role of African-American Men in Movies, published in 2015 by Prager. In her book, she reviews African-American male roles decade by decade, highlighting specific films that often presented the black man in terrible stereotypes and shows how the kinds of parts available to them shifted over time. In addition, Kim discusses black actors who were also social activists to see whether they were hindered by their political work. Welcome to Kimberly Fain. Hi, Kimberly. It's great to talk to you.
Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Your book wonderfully reviews how African-American men were portrayed over the reasonably short history of film. I mean, talking not much more than 100 years, and yet there's already a long and deep history that we can talk about. But let's start with some background. Since the podcast is devoted to authors, I always like to learn something about what leads people to specific writing projects. What are your own personal educational and writing experiences?
Initially, I got my bachelor's degree from Texas A&M University in English. And then I took a detour and decided to get my Doctor of Jurisprudence in Law at Thurgood Marshall School of Law and at Texas University. And then I decided that I still loved writing and researching. And so I decided to go back and get my Master's of English from Texas Southern University as well. Although I am licensed attorney, I continue to teach English. I taught at Texas Southern University, and then I also currently teach English at Houston Community College. I have about, I would say, at least 18 publications, two of them books. And so it just writing continues to be a fascination and love of mine.
But what led you to this particular topic? How did you come up with this subject? I think you wrote something about this already in some of your other shorter works. So what made you decide that it was worth trying to develop into a book?
Well, Spike Lee has always been a favorite of mine in terms of his movies. I would definitely say my favorite director. And so I wrote a chapter, Spike Lee, Rise, Success, and Doing the Right Thing, for a book, Star Power, The Impact of Brand to Celebrity. And I thought that, because I enjoyed the process so much, I thought, wow, I'd like to expand this into an entire book. And I contacted Prager, and it seemed as though someone was already contracted to do Spike Lee, an entire book. So after speaking with which would be my future editor, the acquisition editor, Rebecca Matheson, she suggested, how about something a little more comprehensive that covers more directors and filmmakers? So I said, okay. And I decided to pitch her an idea. And what I became focused on is I said, you know what? I'm really fascinated by the black male image, which is one of the things that Spike Lee focuses on. And I said, I really am interested and fascinated with the treatment of the black male image from 1910s all the way to the 2010s. So I decided to pitch this idea of the image and how the black male image is idealized yet demonized at the same time in pop culture and film. And she accepted it, and we decided to name it Black Hollywood, From Butlers to Superheroes, The Changing Role of African-American Men in the Movies. And so what started out to be just a focus on one filmmaker became something where I focused on a lot of filmmakers. And this became a comprehensive study of just black male in film over a 100-year period.
Obviously, it's an overview it's an overview of the genre, or not the genre, the concept from, like we pointed out, over 100 years. But did you do any specific research? Were you able to talk to anybody, or is this mostly built over your own reading of other authors on the topic and your own viewing of the various films and film projects?
Well, definitely I wanted this to be something that covered several genres, African-American studies, film history, pop culture. And so because this is history-based, you have a situation where you have a lot of people that are not even alive. And then you have others, as I get to the latter portion, where people are still alive. But I didn't really want to focus on what individuals might perceive their role to be, as much as I wanted this to be research-based. And I wanted to basically put together the work of scholars, the work of critics, and include awards, reviews, and put that in as my study so that I could avoid any type of biases that sometimes come with interviewing and interacting with a performer and growing to like the person. And then in that case, you might not really criticize their work objectively.
I know when I was teaching more regularly, I always told students that a primary source is great, but it could have its biases built in as well. I mean, a memoir is going to be, if it's an autobiography, it's probably going to make the person sound as good as possible because they're writing it. So I agree with you that sometimes while interviews can be great, and I've interviewed a number of authors who have built their books around interviews. In this case, you're right, given the time periods, and the synthesis is probably a more logical way, at least in this particular case. Now, the topic has been subject. I mean, we've seen books about African Americans in the movies before, but how did you decide to focus your work to make your specific points that you wanted to make?
Well, one of the things when I was researching, I noticed that a lot of the books focused on exploitation of Blacks and how Blacks were manipulated, taken advantage of, how they did not receive the amount of money that they should have for their work. And I wanted to know where are the victors? Where are the trailblazers now? And were there performers, Black actors, filmmakers who actually were happy with how their careers turned out? And so that's how I decided to focus on empowerment, the success stories. Who were the trailblazers that actually took agency of their work, where there was a certain image that they had to work with to get into the business? And then as time went on, they began to reconstruct and shape that image because they went from being an actor to becoming a producer, executive producer, writer. And that's why I focus, as time goes on, I begin to focus on Spike Lee, Tyler Perry, Will Smith, because they act in their work as well as produce. And with Tyler Perry and Spike Lee, they direct and write. And a lot of people are not really familiar with how successful Overbrook Entertainment is with Will Smith, Tyler Perry Productions, and 40 Acres and a Mule with Spike Lee. Many people are not aware of how successful they have been. With Tyler Perry Productions and Overbrook, their films have made an excess of billions of dollars. Not only that, but I like to focus in this book how different people have become stars from starring in movies that are made by African Americans. So that is one of the areas where I try to be different by focusing on empowering inspirational stories of also how they made social, economic, and political change instead of just focusing on the negativity. I really didn't want to focus on what went wrong, but I try to show what went right with their careers as well.
And we'll talk about the more current ones later, but you're absolutely right. Did you find that some, especially the more current filmmakers, do they consciously or even unconsciously sort of refer back to older, situations and older, African-American actors and roles? I mean, obviously we know Spike Lee's in particular tend to be very, he's very usually, many of his films have a historical basis to them, but did you see a theme more with some of the more current filmmakers that sort of referred back to some of the older films that maybe weren't as well, didn't portray African-American men so well?
I think that it just, it seems like all of the various filmmakers try to pay homage to a certain extent and then add their own twist on. One of the things I noticed with the 1990s, when you have the rise of gangster rap films, there are different times where you will see them try to make a tribute to 1970s blaxploitation performers. And then you also have, when you get to the 2000s, you have various people, Robert Townsend, Keenan Ivory Wayans, who intentionally try to put some of those actors from the past in their films, even if it's for a cameo role. So there's always this acknowledgement that the early African-American actors from 1910s to 1950s, they opened the doors. So there's a homage and there's a respect paid to that. But at the same time, there is, that was the past, and now we are moving towards the future, and there's some differences and changes that we want to make.
The other thing before we, I have some, I want to talk a little bit about specific parts of the book, but it's the kind of thing that sometimes, depending on the book, the cover of the book is particularly striking in this particular case, and the good thing is it'll appear in the podcast listing, so the cover will appear. So I think it's worth talking about it briefly, because we've got basically three people on the cover. Will Smith, of course, in color in the biggest part, and then below him, two smaller pictures to the left, Step and Fetch It, and to the right, Sidney Poitier, but those are in black and white and a little less obviously striking. I don't know whether you had anything to do with the cover, you know, whether you were given the ability to approve or at least comment on the cover, but I think the cover in particular is, does a pretty good job, I think, of sort of, you know, getting with your themes of how the more current actors have a lot to be thankful for, frankly, for some of the things that the older actors did.
No, I completely agree. Actually, originally, what was proposed to me from the marketing team was the picture of James Basquiat, and the picture came from Song of the South. And I didn't really feel like that cover really depicted the theme of our title, because we had already come up with the title from the beginning. And so I said, no, I really don't really like this particular black and white image. How about Step and Fetch It? He should be on the cover. And I also liked images of Sidney Poitier. So I also talked to my husband, Anthony Johnson, who is he's a marketing guru, and he helped me come up with a different idea to propose to them. And they went back to the drawing board, came up with something that included what we wanted, which is the early beginnings, and then an image that reflected the whole concept of superheroes. And this is the image that the marketing team came up with. So it was a combined effort, I think, with the marketing team and with us, my husband and I, to have something that was very reflective of the title.
You clearly proved something to other authors. Make sure you have somebody who's involved in marketing somewhere in your life to bounce ideas off of, because in this case, I couldn't see how that definitely makes for, I mean, I could just see how this book would just sort of pop out in a bookstore, for example, or just in somebody just looking at covers, because of, especially, you know, you use the color of Will Smith, you know, that image is in color and then the other two are in black and white, but it does really pop, which is the term that gets used. So anyway, I do like to ask about that sometimes, especially when you've got a cover like this, which is so striking. Now, obviously you reviewed the films and the topics chronologically, and it seems to me for what you were trying to do, that makes sense. Did you ever consider it any other way, or were you pretty much figuring chronological was the best way to handle this subject?
Well, initially I began to just notice that certain actors or filmmakers were more prominent in certain decades. And so although you have someone like Stephen Fetchett, whose career expanded over several decades, there was a certain time period where he was a height. And so I definitely decided, okay, I think that the 1940s, that was a time where, you know, Bojangles and Stephen Fetchett were at their peak. And so I looked at what their peak decade was. And then after I decided who I wanted to cover and I decided the peak decade, it only seemed natural to put it in chronological order. And also I wanted to connect one chapter to the next. So I noticed that in some cases you have actors who were, as we spoke about earlier, influenced by an actor of an earlier decade. And in some cases they were friends with that actor from an earlier decade. You have, for example, Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. They were influenced by Paul Robeson and Canada Lee. And so it was important to mention, I guess, to connect the significance, because if you really want to connect the significance of their performance and how one actor opened the door for another, it only makes sense to put it in chronological order.
I keep going back and forth, but I want to ask questions based on what you say, and then we'll cover some of the other topics as we go. But did you find, especially in certain periods that you reviewed, that the, for lack of a better way, the political aspect of African-American actors is very important to their success and just important and to their activities that, as you pointed out, Sidney Poitier and as he relates to Paul Robeson, who obviously had two strikes against him, I guess you could say, but in particular because of his, you know, could you say that it's more obvious that African-American roles tend to be affected more politically than maybe some of the other more typical Hollywood actor roles?
Oh, I agree with that completely, because oftentimes with Black actors, and we're not even just talking about the studios then, because the studio and is always thinking about how this role or this image will be looked upon by not just Black audiences, but white audiences as well. You have the Black actor as well, who's looking at the script and trying to decide if this is something that they want. Is this the role they want to play? And how will this role affect the community? One example I have of that is Sidney Poitier when he plays In the Heat of the Night. And he is concerned, Rod Steiger, the other cop that, or the actor that he works with that plays a cop in the film, slaps him. And he actually had in his contract, Sidney Poitier actually put in the contract, if he slaps me, nowhere in the world will it be edited out that I take that slap. It was important for Sidney Poitier to demonstrate equality, especially in the times that we're looking at, the 1960s. And so he wanted that image on screen because politically the country was dealing with those issues of social equality. So he wanted the film to mirror the political changes that were occurring in the country. And I think that Black actors always have that on their mind. How will this role be received both politically and socially? And sometimes they pursue roles for that purpose. Sometimes they write roles for that purpose. But I don't really see how, and that's why I connect the social, the economic, and the political. I don't really see how the Black actor can separate themselves from, I guess they can look at it as a burden, but they can also look at it as a way to empower the audience as well. But they really cannot separate themselves from the political aspect of the role.
And I think that's the case with African Americans in particular and other minorities in other professions. For example, there, when it comes to sports, that particularly in baseball, more so than any other sport, I think, the importance of Jackie Robinson in baseball is still felt today by African American players and other people who understood how important he was and what he went through. And the same thing with other kinds of professions where what came before is so important that you never want to forget those ties.
Exactly. Definitely.
So now let's start talking about some of the specific chapters where we talk about, where you talk about specific roles, actors, and films. Let's go back to the beginning, of course, which is not, and not surprisingly, centers around Birth of a Nation, a movie that to this day is still incredibly controversial, in where you get people who feel like it shouldn't even be shown, let alone, but, and yet it's studied quite a bit in film schools. In fact, the first time I ever saw it was in a film class. Nowadays, of course, you can get it in, on, you know, video and Netflix and other places. But what, obviously, in these early films, African Americans are portrayed poorly, terribly. And in this particular case, of Birth of a Nation, they're often portrayed by white people. How were these initial roles, or these initial characterizations, what led them to be so terrible? I mean, how were what was going on in particular that made filmmakers decide that this was the way they were going to portray African American men?
I'm not sure exactly why D.W. Griffith in Birth of a Nation wanted to portray African Americans so negatively. I do know that his motivation was to promote white supremacy. So I don't know that he said to himself, okay, I'm going to intentionally portray them horribly. I don't think that he really thought he was portraying African Americans horribly. And at that time, you know, the term was Negroes. I think that he thought that he was portraying blacks authentically from his white male perspective. And one of the things that comes out in The Birth of a Nation is Southern white fear of the black male. But also this fear of integration, because at this time you have segregation, Jim Crow era, and you still have fears of miscegenation. And that comes out prominently in his film. And so what ends up happening is that in order for him to stress why races should be separate, he has to include the black rapist archetype. He has to include other stereotypical images. For example, he has blacks taking over Congress and depriving whites of the vote. If by focusing on this era, okay, this idea of liberation of the slaves and how terrible it is for the South, he dramatizes it, but also he keeps those ideas and fears in people's minds. And again, unfortunately, that type of thing was so upsetting to people that it actually led to, you know, some riots and protest as well. And I think that he didn't care about how it was received or thought of by blacks. I think his very intention was to promote white supremacy. It's clear. And to continue this concept of white fear. But the result, what you have to do to create that, is that you do have to exaggerate negative stereotypes about blacks in order to convey that message.
And I think part of the issue in particular, I think with Griffith and the South and the fact that he was from the South, unfortunately, after the Civil War, the and some of the things I've read, you know, in post, you know, Reconstruction and post-Civil War periods, is that to a large extent, it was the Southerners who were able to rewrite history or write the history of the post, of the Reconstruction era. And unfortunately, that had became, particularly not only during this period, but even going forward till much later in the century, that Griffith's view of what was going on in the South, particularly both during the Civil War and afterwards, was the correct historical view. In fact, one of the re-releases of Birth of a Nation contained a introduction in which Griffith is talking with someone else, and he more or less says this: he couldn't understand why people were so upset with his film, and he sort of says, this is the way it happened, and I don't see any reason why this is a problem. So it's not a surprise that, unfortunately, people would accept his view, because that was the accepted view.
Exactly. And people don't realize how common, his perspectives were very common. Based on my research, they said that he based this film on Thomas Dixon's novels, Another Southerner, The Klansman, and The Left Spots. And these two novels were very racist novels. And so he really kind of took this concept and he ran with it. And he was very profitable as well, because there were a lot of people who actually agreed with the images that they saw. I think when I look at the film, it's almost tragically comical in many ways, because it's such an exaggeration and it's very ridiculous. But at the same time, I do realize that it's painful for some people as well to look at it. And I think that the movie has to continue to be shown as a cautionary tale of what we don't want to go back to, in a way, of what we definitely want to deviate from and avoid.
Of course, silent films tended to be over, you know, they had to be exaggerated to an extent, but you sometimes wonder, you know, would he have still used that kind of exaggeration, given that the way the black actors were portrayed, or the black characters, where they were particularly acting, you know, almost comical as you in the way they acted, and simpletons almost is the best word I can use to describe them.
Yeah, I think they probably would have, and maybe it would have been worse if we could have actually heard sound, because then really heard the words that he would put in their mouths.
Right. But then, of course, in the next chapter, you talk about how there was a conscious effort to try to fight back against the portrayals of particularly Birth of a Nation, but some of the other films during that period. And the one person that you bring up and that you talk about is Oscar Michaud. And I think I got that right. I asked you before him, but who was he and why was he so important to this, particularly this period, but even going forward with African-American roles in films?
Well, Oscar Michaud is quite incredible, because he really was the first prolific black director of the world, really. 43 films were produced by him, but only 15 of them survived. So you really can't talk about black film without talking about Oscar Michaud. And so I definitely wanted to include him as the beginning. His movies were incredible because he really talks about racial uplift. At the same time, he takes characters, he has black characters of various different skin colors. And occasionally he uses blackface, but when he does, it's for satirical purposes. As well as sometimes he actually had black actors who were very fair-skinned wear very light makeup to play white actors. Because really at this time, you can't really put black actors and white actors in a film together without a certain level of controversy. So he definitely widened the scope and the image. Don't get me wrong, he does use villains in his movies. And the villains are not just white, the villains may be black as well. But I guess he thought, as well as African-American press thought, the best way to respond, you do have this element of protesting, you have this element of where people, you know, decide to riot. But then you have the artistic response. And Oscar Michaud says, hey, people seem to be interested in black people and black culture. Let's show black culture, black people, black actors with a level of authenticity. And I will help construct this image. And that's what the African-American press encouraged, that if blacks didn't like the way they were portrayed, they had to get involved in directing, get involved in writing, get involved in the process. And if you're involved in the process, you can change the output or the outcome.
That's one of the reasons why I really wanted to bring him up so importantly as we're talking, because while we see that obviously in more recent times, He's unusual in the fact that when he was in the time period, I mean, the fact that he was doing this at the same time as Griffith and some of the early filmmakers. And that is really, it's the kind of thing that people tend not to know about. And really, it's unfortunate, number one, that he's not well known or not more well known. And secondly, that so many of his works have disappeared.
Exactly.
But so did he have, what in particular did he do? I mean, I think you talk about how that he purposely tried to make a film that answered Birth of a Nation, if I read correctly what you were talking about. What did he do in particular to try to fight back against the Birth of a Nation portrayal?
Well, various things you'll have in his films. He will confront various racial issues, Ku Klux Klan. He confronts these issues and tackles them in a way that demonstrates a lack of fear of talking about the issues. One of the things that happens, though, with Michaud that does not happen as much with white directors is that they edit his films a lot. And they edit it for basically censorship because some of the images that he portrayed made people uncomfortable. The way he confronted white racism made people very uncomfortable with his ideas and with his themes. And so that is one of the things that he had to face. His first film that survived, actually, it's the second film, Within Our Gates. And one of the things they said about the film is that it had spectacular shots of the Klan riding at night with torches. And this was a scene that they did decide to, you know, keep in the film. And so one of the ways he combated the perceptions in the Birth of the Nation is by showing characters that were fully realized human beings, African-Americans that were educated, African-Americans that spoke well, African-Americans that had different class levels. And that was one of the ways that he directly, you know, responded to the Birth of the Nation, because the Birth of the Nation, it shows blacks as being very ignorant and not basically not civilized. And at the same time, this was good that Michaud did this. Towards the end of his career, he starts to get a lot of criticism for this as well, because they felt like he focused too much on educated blacks and blacks of means, or middle class blacks, I guess you could say. And they felt that he was not giving a fully complex portrait of African Americans. But this is the best way he knew as an artist to reject the blackface images, to show blacks of various skin colors, skin tones, class levels, and education, playing us, playing our stories. That was the best way to combat the blackface images of the Birth of a Nation.
Of course, then we can move forward a little bit. And once again, the portrayal of African Americans, particularly now with a film that was even, that to this day is even more well regarded, and that's Gone with the Wind, based on a novel that was very popular, which then was translated into a film where the depiction of African Americans pretty much stayed the same. And while at first glance may not seem as overtly racist as Birth of a Nation, there's no question that it is still, it's just unbelievable. And unfortunately for the time period, to have a film like that come out and the way it portrayed not only slavery and how slavery wasn't possibly that bad, so to speak, you know, it was hard work, but they were okay, to how African-American men in particular were depicted. And so, like, for example, with Gone with the Wind, how are men shown differently, say, than even black women?
Really, with black males, they show them as very content with their position and lacking in ambition and desiring nothing more than to serve their masters, so to speak, even after, you know, they become servants, there is this emphasis on their low intelligence. And this to me is a little bit different because at the time of Gone with the Wind, 1930s, at that time period, and then when you're reflecting back to the Civil War era, roles with women, like the roles in society, were very limited. I think Black women and white women can agree that they probably didn't like the way they were portrayed on film at this time. But for a Black male to show him as not really being interested in supporting and taking care of his family and not desiring more out of life than to serve another human being, is particularly, I would say, emasculating, because even back at that time, you've always, really since the beginning, Black males have always desired to participate in the American dream and the American experience. The ambition and desire has always been there. But you have this film, Gone with the Wind, and you just have monolithic characters who are just happy to serve, which is not really reality at that time or even now.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that, obviously, having been somebody who's watched film my entire life, and I have seen Gone with the Wind a number of times, and I've actually have friends who, generally speaking, we get along quite well. It's the one subject that I have a problem with is discussing Gone with the Wind. You know, they'll say things like, well, you have to look at it as a film and how great it is as a film. And I understand that, but it becomes very difficult to ignore the underlying racism that permeates the film. And then, of course, the overall view of Civil War and Reconstruction and the way it presented as if that was the way of life that should have remained. You know, the whole Gone with the title at the beginning, where that was gone, that whole era was Gone with the Wind.
Exactly. It's amazing that this film basically glorifies the dehumanization of an entire race. And it's hard for me to really enjoy the flick. Obviously, I had to watch it again writing this book, and I watched it as a child and really did not understand what was going on when I was watching it then. I just knew that, you know, the actresses were pretty, you know, and they looked pretty in their dresses. And so you see things one way as a child, and then you become older and you start to analyze it. But it was a lifting up of a time when you had one group that dominated another. And it really makes it hard to enjoy a film that just shows really one perspective of whites and one perspective of blacks. I think both whites and blacks are disturbed by the images in Gone with the Wind.
Well, that's what we say. It not only disturbs, but I mean, you know, it's supposed to say that the Southern way was the best way of life, no matter whether you're white or black. And exactly. So, of course, the only Northerners that appear in the film are all scoundrels and bad people.
Exactly. So everyone got a little taste of stereotyping in that film.
I sometimes wonder if any black writers have or filmmakers have ever talked about sort of what you just said, how Gone with the Wind affected their view of film. And it's a subject all by itself that I think is very interesting, just because I think because when we just went past the 75th anniversary of the film, and so, of course, we're hearing all these great discussions about how great the film was, everything. And I just felt there wasn't enough writing about that aspect of it, that the negatives of it. And it was cheered and all these things, and not enough. I felt there wasn't enough writing about the negatives and how it would be tough for some people to watch the film knowing the underlying treatments of people in the film.
And not only that, but the reality of slavery. Really, when you know history and you know what was really going on, it's just really hard to enjoy a movie that makes slavery or servitude look like something that is glamorous to a certain extent, or definitely not that much of a hardship. it's just not based in reality in any sort of way. So it's just difficult for me to watch it for those reasons as well.
Then moving forward, we get into the period of time that, in this particular case, affected both whites and black actors, and that's the blacklisting period of the 50s, going into the late 40s and early 50s, when the issues of blacklisting, particularly for leftist beliefs, but obviously then there was also the racial aspect. Who were some of the people who were most affected by the blacklist, African-American actors, and was their treatment worse than even white blacklisted actors?
I would think that if you suffered under the blacklist, you would feel like your treatment is probably the worst. But with Canada Lee and Paul Robeson, I thought that the way it affected them, probably from the black male perspective, they would feel like it affected them more. Because with some of the white actors that were involved in this, or white, should I say white writers, some of them were able to sometimes have friends write, or they were able to use their friends' names. And so they were still able to write in a way without using their own name. Some of them traveled outside of the United States and found work there. But with Paul Robeson, you have a situation, and with Canada Lee, they actually tried to keep them from traveling. So you have that issue. And then in addition to that, you have Canada Lee. He's really going from being a stage star to really trying to break out in films. And he's in these films, and he thinks that he's going to, like in Lifeboat, he thought he would have a more prominent part. And he's cut out of the film to have a smaller role. So he's confronting the issue of trying to play bigger parts and wanting to become a film star, people promising that is the direction that he'll go in. But then you have all of these rumors spreading that he's associating with communists. And then in addition to that, he's dealing with the racism that's already there. So when you couple having to deal with racism, and then in addition to that, you have the government watching you and keeping you under surveillance, you start to have people that don't want to associate with you. And one of the things that some of his family believed is they felt like being blacklisted really led to his death, that, you know, he had a heart attack, he died of a broken heart. So they felt like it stressed him out so much, and the pressure to name Paul Robeson, which is why I include him in this chapter as well, the pressure to name Paul Robeson is extreme for him as well. And he does not do that by all accounts. With Paul Robeson, I mean, he's a big stage star as well, singer and film actor. And he has this extreme concern for social justice. And so when they start looking at him and trying to isolate him as well from people, you know, there is, and I don't really get into this with in the book, but he does, you know, begin to suffer later on in his life from, you know, maybe mental illness. And he started to get very paranoid as well. And see, Paul Robeson was so big, I didn't want him to become the entire book. And so that's how he was affected by it. His career never revives. And then you have with Canada Lee, him dying during the 50s, he never gets an opportunity to see his way out of this blacklisting era. So I would think that everyone would feel that, you know, where this happened to them, they would feel that they were adversely affected. But I think that when you're a black actor, especially at this time, you have less access to resources anyway. So when you are pointed out as an enemy of the state, I think it would be much harder for you to economically survive as well as revive your career.
I guess that's more or less what I meant before about having two strikes against you. Not only do you have to worry about the blacklist because of supposed leftist leanings, but also being African-American in a period of time where, you know, you didn't have, you were still deprived of many rights, and you put the two together, and it does mean pretty obviously that the deck stacked against you 100%.
Exactly.
So, but going forward, then now we get into the late 50s, early 60s, and we're starting to get into the civil rights has become more important, and there are slowly but surely, and I do mean slowly, we start to see some changes in social and political life. How does the portrayal of African American men start to change during this period?
Well, really, when you get to Sidney Poitier, this is when you start to, and this chapter on 1960s, I focus on Sidney Poitier and Harold Belafonte. They both were very good friends, both of them from the West Indies. Their birthdays are actually 8 days apart. And they're coming up at the same time. And you have Sidney Poitier, who is really becomes the biggest actor at the time. And then you have Harry Belafonte, who is a major matinee idol. And they're experiencing success on such a high level, and economically, they're doing well. But at the same time, they are still limited. There's still a limited access in certain parts of the country, in the South, and even some parts of the North. And so with Harry Belafonte, he actually refers to himself as saying, hey, he felt like an angry black man. And this is one of the things that really made him focus on the civil rights movement. He was very involved. A lot of people don't know how much he was involved with Martin Luther King Jr. One of the things is that he actually was like the connection between the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. The Kennedys did not feel comfortable speaking to Martin Luther King. And so Harry Belafonte would transmit messages between the two. Also, Harry Belafonte was instrumental in getting a lot of money for some of the marches for the Freedom Riders. He would raise money, and he would get money from a lot of very well-off people. A lot of them were white, whether they were celebrities or politicians. And so he was instrumental in this, that he very much understood that even though he and Sidney could reach such heights and change images on screen, there were some things that needed to change politically as well. So although Harry Belafonte and Sidney are seen in a very positive light, and they intentionally said that they chose roles that showed blacks in a positive way, they tried to confront racial issues in their movies, and then they also confronted those racial issues in the political realm as well.
And I think that's what I sort of brought up earlier when I said that there seemed to be almost, I don't want to say requirement, but a duty for people who were successful, who started to see some success, in this case, like you say, with the two men now we're talking about, that they almost had to make sure that they made the most of their abilities, not only because of their success and their popularity and their fame, but to make sure that they did something with it that hopefully was helpful to other people who needed a lot of help during this period.
Oh, definitely.
But then, as we go through this period then, but one of the things that you talked about, and you've got actually two different chapters, but they both are somewhat similar in that they're we start to see films that are dominated by black men who enjoyed initial success in other entertainment fields, such as comedians and then also singers and hip hop artists. And why were they successful in getting roles and the ability to have some control over how they were portrayed?
Well, definitely what you have with the comedians, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, and then when you have the gangster rappers, as they say, they had a built-in audience. They already had a number of people that were interested in their art form. Not only that, they had reached a level of commercial success and had acquired mainstream success as well. And so producers and white studios felt as though we have, it's less of less of an economic risk if we use some of these individuals. With Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor, they were able to get deals with studios where they would be able to produce, and as well as if they wanted to direct and star in the films they wanted to be in, because they were able to bring people to the movie theater, and they were able to bring audiences to movie theater because they had been so successful in their comedic careers. So it's kind of like one thing leads to the other. When you have a built-in audience, and then they take a chance on you with the movie, and if the movie is profitable, you begin to have more power in Hollywood, whether you're black or white. At the end of the day, it's really about making money.
It's interesting that the difference is it took a lot longer for the African Americans to be able, artists to be able to take advantage of this. Obviously, the white artists were able to do this quite a while earlier. We've got, of course, Elvis Presley, who only made, you know, the studios love making films with him because they had the music built in, and they also knew people would come to see him just because it was Presley. And even going back earlier than that, Frank Sinatra, who, of course, started as a singer, but then developed into a pretty well-known actor. It just took a lot longer, unfortunately, before African-Americans were able to take advantage of the crossover effect.
No, I completely agree, because although you have Stephen Fetchett, who was a comedian on stage at first, he does end up making a lot of money, he really does not change the social or political landscape. And so films really don't change for black actors because of him, because of his presence on screen. And then, like you said, when you get to the 1950s, we have Harry Belafonte. So he has his built-in audience as a singer, but he really still is not able to have the same kind of access and control. He tries to in television, and I don't talk about it too much because I wanted to focus on films, but he still is not able to do with, like what you say, Elvis Presley does in the 1950s. It does take a while before blacks are able to command the same kind of attention and the same type of monies as their white counterparts.
So then going through, and you go all the way up to almost present day with what you wrote, where are we today? I mean, what kind of issues are we still seeing with the African-American male in film, or have things improved enough now that we can be, that this is not the same as it obviously has changed from in 100 years, but, or are there still issues that we still see regularly occurring that can clearly be, looked at as on a racial level?
When you say issues, you mean issues in terms of behind the scenes or directors and writers?
Everything related to how African-American men are portrayed and how that happens. Is it, you know, between the actors and the writers and the directors and even film production companies that are making the films?
Well, there still seems to be really an issue, because you really don't have that many black filmmakers. Most people cannot even name 10 of them. So you have various filmmakers who still have to struggle a little harder to get funding for their projects. And remember, you know, you have to partner up with others. And so there's a difficulty sometimes in acquiring enough money for the production. And then you have as well, you have to pay the actors who are in the film. So you have that issue, which is always, it's always an economic issue. And then you have people starting to open up, because you've had some recently various movies like Straight Out of Compton and a few other movies that have people realizing, okay, black films can make money. So I think we're in the midst of a lot of changes that are going on with movies and television. However, the representation in terms of movies or in filmmakers is really still not there, not as much as it needs to be. I do feel that in terms of diverse depictions, yes, that's much better. You still have stereotypical roles, but you still, at the same time, you do have African Americans playing superheroes. You have, you know, Michael B. Jordan in the Fantastic Four. You have Anthony Mackie playing in Captain America. So you're starting to see, you see African Americans and their range, the ability to play in roles. You have Jamie Foxx, who will play a slave or an ex-slave in Django Unchained, and then in another movie, White House Down, play president. So you're seeing the range, and the range is there. The representations are definitely becoming more diverse and multi-layered. But in terms of behind the scenes, I really can only think of only a few major Black production companies that are run by African Americans. And so that's where there still needs to be work. And I think, you know, many people will agree on that. And not only that, you still have Americans attracted to the more negative images. So getting more positive images to be reflected on screen and getting audiences there, that also is another struggle.
I'm wondering whether, I mean, you mentioned this as part of what you were saying, that's the lack of positive depictions or the lessening, not as many as you really want to see, because like you point out, some of the most popular films, unfortunately, sometimes the people are the actors are portraying people who aren't that particularly good or nice or right. positive in any way, shape, or form.
Well, I think it's okay to show the multiplicity of the Black culture. And you are going to have Black villains. I think that, you know, we all enjoy Denzel Washington and Training Day. And so I don't want to leave this. I don't want to have this idea that we can only show Blacks in a positive way. I just think that the roles definitely need to be diverse in terms of showing the range. With most people, there is this element of extremes that we can go either way. So showing characters that can tap into the most positive or negative part of themselves is a good way to show that Black range and to get out of a stereotypical mold of depicting the Black male in one way.
Well, of course, you mentioned Denzel Washington, and there's no question that he has been willing, and I'm going to ask you if there are other actors around the same, you know, African-American actors who are the same way. He's been perfectly willing to play on all different levels. I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, Training Day, but then, of course, there's also American Gangster, and then, of course, there's also Flight, where he obviously doesn't come off well in these films, but yet he's willing to do them because he feels like these are good roles, and so they're worth doing. Are there other African-American actors that you can think of that are on that same level as far as what they choose and why they choose what they do?
Well, Idris Elba, he is definitely an actor that will show various range. He played Mandela. However, one of the things I noticed with a lot of Black male actors is that they are definitely floating in between television and film. Like, for example, you have Terrence Howard, and he appears in The Butler. And then at the same time, you have him in Empire. And in Empire, he would be considered probably a villain. He's a hero, but he definitely is a villain as well. So I'm noticing that there's some Black actors that will tend to be more positive when they're in film roles, but when they take on a television role, maybe because, you know, it offers the opportunity for range, they are willing to play negative, or I wouldn't say negative, but villains, villainous type characters, because some actors enjoy playing those type of characters. They actually enjoy it, and they find it to be, I guess you could say, fun. But where you take a Will Smith, really, the majority of his roles, he tends to try to play positive characters for the most part. So I think that, you know, the question that you asked, it's a really good question. But many people would say that Denzel Washington does it best.
Yeah, I think part of it is because, I mean, your points about television, I think most people believe that some of the best writing is going on in television these days.
mm-hmm. now, whether it's coming through perfectly or not, but there's no question that, and I think it's got to do with the number of places that you can, I mean, obviously on in a movie theater, you only got a certain number of movie theaters, but when you've got as many channels as we have available, both pay and free, and now digital modes like Netflix and Amazon, who are now doing, you know, brand new series and things, there's a lot of places for not niche, I don't want to call it a niche interest, but certainly more wide ranges than you might be able to find in feature films.
I think that definitely is probably what it is. As the space is bigger, therefore there's more opportunities. And I would think Samuel L. Jackson, he's another actor who definitely, in Django Unchained, you can definitely consider him to be a villain. And I guess the Uncle Tom archetype. And then at the same time, he plays, you know, superhero Nick Fury with the Marvel Comics. So he has that range as well of going from he can play in movies villains as well as play someone that we can admire and look to as a role model. So Samuel L. Jackson definitely does not seem to fear exploring his range.
Well, and plus he also was got to be one of the two major African American male actors who have made it, you know, made a splash in the Star Wars films. So,
oh, definitely.
Him and Billy Dee Williams. So anyway, then wrapping up, what kind of writing plans do you have going forward? Are you working on any other project at this point that you'd like to talk about?
Oh, well, I am working on another project. I am probably won't discuss it at this time. I'd like to get the contract first. That's kind of how I do it.
That makes sense.
I do have another book that came out this year as well, Colson Whitehead. And so, you know, he's a premier African-American author. And so I kind of wanted to examine with him his post-racial characters and post-racial perspective and how he deals with Black masculinity and Black manhood and various novels that he's written, The Intuitionist and John Henry, to name a few, A Zone One. And so with these two major projects coming out this year, I have begun started writing again, but I definitely want to get the contract first before I share, but I'm definitely willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual for an author to be able to say they actually had two works in the same year and wide-ranging. One's film, the other's author, but completely different ways of looking at your topics, which is great. I mean, nothing wrong with showing some range in your writing abilities.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because the Colson Whitehead one came out May 15th of this year and then Black Hollywood June 30th. So I was writing on them both at the same time, so... It was good to switch my head back and forth between, you know, literature and film history. But definitely both books did have something in common in terms of dealing with Black masculinity and its treatment over a period of years.
Well, I'd like to really thank you for talking to me. I'm glad we were able to set this up. This book was, I think, deserves every bit of praise it's gotten, and also the fact of the matter is I think it should serve not only as a readable book all by itself, but I could also see how it could be very useful, say, in film classes and even depending on the kind of course it is, that you might be able to, you know, a popular culture film that, or a class that specifically deals with African Americans, I could see how it could be very useful there as well. So thank you for talking to me, and I really enjoyed our discussion.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Kimberly Feng. I hope you will also check out her interview for her book, Colson Whitehead, The Post-Racial Voice of Contemporary Literature, also available on the New Books Network. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.